This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
It's a big week here on Liner Note Leftovers, my lovelies, because you get two. It's a two for week. I couldn't sit on this one any longer. I was so excited with how the first episode went that I had to do another one. By which I mean I wasn't beaten to death with vinyl cleaning brushes by a bunch of art house hipsters with an armful of experimental jazz records. I haven't infuriated the vinyl gods yet, so we're gonna tell some more stories. I got a big week for you, my lovelies, and I am talking big. I'm talking aliens. I'm talking Ferraris. I'm talking a whole lot of communists. It don't make sense now, but it will on another episode of Liner Note Leftovers. Let's get into it, vinyl nerds. Here we go. We got a little bit of recent history to start with on Liner Note Leftovers, but I think we've all pondered from time to time what's outside of our planet, what's going on in the cosmos. And eventually, one day, we might have to meet them. Will they be friendly, like that movie Paul? Or will they be not so friendly as every other alien movie, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and Stephen Hawking have all said they won't be? I don't know, but we gotta pick a good representative so we don't make this advanced species who traveled to us very mad. You know, this is one of those times where I ponder what's going on in Tom DeLonge's head with this information. Dude wrote aliens exist and nobody wants him to speak to the aliens, at least according to a poll which was opened on March 22nd, 2004, which voted probably the most unlikely person to be in charge of speaking with the aliens when they come, and that was Ozzy Osbourne, the Prince of Darkness himself. Long before Numa Numa and long before Bodie McBoatface, this is one of the first examples of meme culture online. Because this poll was put out online by Yahoo, and everybody voted for Ozzy. And this wasn't even close. He took most of the vote. He beat UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. He beat then US President George Bush, who only took in 8% of the vote. But looking back, that kind of makes sense. Also, it's really funny because Bush tied with a glamour model for the amount of votes they got. But if you really think about it, this poll came out when they were discovering water on Mars for the first time. Now we know there could very well be life up there, so it could be a possibility that old Ozzy speaks with the aliens. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. He's one of the greatest of our musicians. I mean, sure, he's not a classic virtuoso, but I would say there's been a reason the guy's had some longevity. If you can understand Ozzy's Brummy accent, then you will be able to understand any other language on the planet. It just gets easier from there. And this is very true, the aliens would also have a fun time studying Ozzy, because Ozzy has a genetic mutation, which is why he's been physically able to keep partying like this his whole life. Think about it. You got the musical talent, you got the scientific marvel, and you got some of the most badass things that have ever happened in the history of human nature all rolled into one. Tell me what alien wouldn't want to talk to that. Also, Ozzy does think that the pyramids were based on alien spaceships, possibly, if you watch the Osbournes Want to Believe. So, who knows? I think it's a good pitch. But right now, scary little green men. Ozzy talking to the aliens, perhaps?
They want us! They need us. They might just try to eat us. They'll greet us, deceive us. Say, take us to the unleader. Everybody wants them. I'm gonna meet them. Everybody wants them. It's the end. Scary little green men. Do you believe them? Scary little green men. It's the end.
You know, there's a lot of things that you can count as the contributors to ending the Cold War, unless you think it's not really over and we're just waiting for the epic sequel very, very soon. But I don't know that one of those was Fleetwood Mac, though it could have been.
Now, a lot of us who were born after the Cold War might not necessarily understand the logistical nightmare getting a rock and roll band over the Iron Curtain was, especially in the 60s and 70s when it was the height of tensions between the United States and the then USSR. Now, how does this tie into Fleetwood Mac? and a Rolling Stone article in 1978 that said they were going to be the first American rock band in Russia. Well, for that, we got to go back to 1977. Fleetwood Mac is pitched the idea of doing a three-day television special live from Moscow, and all the funds be given to UNESCO, which is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And Fleetwood Mac says, absolutely, that's something we'd like to do. Explore the options. So, Michael Shapiro had to go to the Russian embassy and the U.S. State Department to make sure that this concert could go ahead without starting an international incident. Which, if you remember the Cold War, it did not take much to set those two nations off against each other. And apparently it even went so far as to Russian ambassadors meeting with Fleetwood Mac. And according to news articles of the day, it was a very receptive meeting that, according to a completely unconfirmed story, may have ended with a 3 a.m. drinking contest between Christine McVie and a Soviet press counselor named Valentin Kamenev.
Found an Associated Press scrap from around that time from a journalist who would have been covering rock and roll matters, but that's the best I can do. That's why I say unconfirmed.
However, it is kind of believable when you consider the hard partying lifestyle of Fleetwood Mac at the time. But this meeting of the minds between the biggest rock band in the world at the time and the Soviet Union kind of fizzled into nothing. Was it because they just couldn't get the logistics down of having a rock and roll concert in the USSR at the time? Was it, as Fleetwood Mac's lawyer Michael Shapiro said, that it was contingent on world peace, and the next year the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, so that didn't go ahead? Or was it because in the meantime the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band became the first American rock band to play in Russia, and all the Russians were mad at us because they were stuck trying to figure out the Cadillac Ranch with no frame of reference? Trust me, I've been there when I moved to Alberta. I would be pretty mad too. Either way, imagine what the world would have been like if the USSR had heard the Rumors album live. I have a feeling that would impact world history a little bit.
The best piece of advice I could ever give you is always listen to your mechanic, whether it's that knocking noise in your engine or who you should put in as the new singer of your band, because somehow they always seem to get it right. And that thought there ties into how Van Hagar came to be. Because if we go back to 1986, Van Halen, for all intents and purposes, had broken up. And there was a lot of bad blood. Eddie felt like David Lee Roth had abandoned the rest of the band to become a movie star. David Lee Roth felt that Eddie and the rest of the band were strangleholding him into not being able to be creative in his own way. And it all boiled to a head. Van Halen officially was no more. Allegedly, Warner Brothers even said, "It's over forever, guys. Just don't bother with Van Halen anymore. Do something else." But not to be discouraged, quietly, Eddie Van Halen, Alex Van Halen, and Michael Anthony were looking for a new singer, with one of the biggest contenders being Patti Smith. Not that Patti Smith, another Patti Smith, the one that had that great duet with Don Henley. But she turned them down because she only wanted to record one album with Van Halen, but the band wanted her permanently, and she's like, "I can't go with you guys. You party all the time. You're nuts. I'm 8 months pregnant. It's not gonna fly." So, hum-de-dum, it goes on a little bit longer. The search continues until Eddie Van Halen takes his Ferrari into his mechanic, a guy by the name of Claudio Zampoli. And while the two are shooting the breeze, he looks over, he sees another nice-looking Ferrari, and he says, "Hey, whose car's that?" And Zampoli says, "Oh, that car belongs to Sammy Hagar. Hey, you should put him in your band." Now, Hagar was getting real big at the time because he had a hit song called "I Can't Drive 55. Very fitting, you see how it goes. But the two end up striking up a conversation. Eddie invites Sammy to a jam session, and they find they got a lot of chemistry together. So much so that they drop an album called 5150, named after Eddie Van Halen's studio studio and also the police code for a mentally disturbed person in California. Kind of fits, kind of makes sense, but it was very interesting to see how this all shaked out because Van Halen purists hated the concept of Van Hagar. And when 5150 dropped, I know a lot of us think it's a classic now, it was met with very middling reviews, including one particularly brutal review in the Village Voice that said, "One wonders how the guitar mavens who thought Eddie equaled Van Halen are going to like his fireworks displays and balls to the walls hooks now that video star David Lee Roth has been given way to one of the biggest schmucks in the known music business. No musician with something to say could stomach responding to Sammy Hagar's call, and this album proves it." Ugh, yikes, I felt rough reading that. But it ended up working out, because 5150 was Van Halen's biggest selling album to date. It beat 1984, and the rest is history. Until infighting led to Sammy Hagar being kicked out. Gary Cherone from Extreme was in there for a while, and that was a mess. But one interesting fact to leave you on, and something that makes you think you should always believe in your dreams. Before Eddie Van Halen and Sammy Hagar met on that fateful day at the Ferrari dealership, Hagar predicted to his wife Betsy that he was going to be Van Halen's new singer. He was waiting for that call any day, and it just so happened to be helped along by a very helpful mechanic. So always, always listen to your car guy. From the 5150 album, this is Why Can't This Be Love? It's got what it takes. So tell me, why can't this be love? Straight from my heart. Oh, tell me, why can't this be love? All right, this is going to be a big one here, but I'm going to try and keep it concise. I could talk all day about Elton John. He's one of my biggest rock and roll heroes. And the man, born Reginald Dwight, but known better as Elton Hercules John, was born the week we recorded this, March 25th, 1947. And along his prolific career, the dude has shown that he is a guy that any young musician should look up to, because that dude knows the work that it takes to become one of the biggest artists of all time. And here are just some fast facts about how prolific his career was. He was trained at the Royal Academy of Music starting at the age of 11, but dropped out before graduation because he wanted to form a rock and roll career. He met songwriter Bertie Taupin, who has written most of the lyrics while Elton does most of the melodies. According to both of them, it only takes about 20 minutes to write a hit song, but they don't do it in the same room. Bernie writes the lyrics, sends it to Elton, they've got something ready before an episode of Seinfeld is over. He's got an insane discography, starting with Empty Sky all the way back in 1969, made up of 30 studio albums, 5 live albums, 18 compilation albums, 3 internet albums, 3 EPs, 7 soundtracks, and 3 tribute albums. When it comes to the most amount of concerts ever played by an artist, Elton John is right up there at the top, playing almost 3,500 shows in his career, including 62 alone at Madison Square Garden, selling out every single time, more than any other artist that has ever played Madison Square Garden. Interestingly enough, you remember how we were talking how Fleetwood Mac was supposed to play in the USSR as a building bridges between East and West? Well, Elton John was actually the one who filled that gap, because instead of playing just one show, he played 6 in Moscow and then what was called Leningrad, in a show that was called so moving that Soviet generals who were in the audience were crying and cheering for his music. Now tell me that that's not a wild scene. He's written the music of some of your favorite Disney movies, including The Lion King, which is an absolutely classic soundtrack. He's the one that convinced John Lennon to get back into the solo music game, and even convinced him to play his last live show at Madison Square Garden in 1974. He released 4 number one albums within 1 year, but he's kind of a humble dude. He'll also play your wedding, if you happen to have $1 million laying around. But don't worry, he doesn't keep it. He puts it towards charity, the Elton John AIDS Foundation, which has been massive in research in that regard. And also, just one more thing, the Elton John Rocket Hour, entirely devoted to new music and classic tracks that you should know. Check that out if you're ever looking for that new great artist you gotta hear. It's all about lifting up the people that come after. So on Elton John's special day, and by the way, on his special day, he's giving you a birthday present. Right now, you can stream 1967's song Scarecrow, which is the very first song he ever wrote with Bernie Taupin. My fellow music nerds, you'll appreciate that, but I gotta stop, I gotta find a place to end, because again, I could talk about Elton John all day. Did you also know there were bleachers named after him at the Watford Football Club, because he used to own... No, I'm gonna stop, and I'm gonna play a little bit of that long-lost tune, the first ever Elton John-Bernie Taupin pairing. This is Scarecrow. The Rolling Stones tongue and lips logo. It's as iconic as Coca-Cola or the McDonald's logo. You could show it to somebody who hadn't been outside for 60 years and they'd be like, oh yeah, let's go listen to Gimme Shelter. That's how ubiquitous it is. But it was almost not as we know it. And this is a common misconception that Andy Warhol designed the tongue and lips logo. He did not. I don't blame you for thinking that because he did actually design a lot of rock and roll logos at the time, including the classic Velvet Underground, Peel Me and See, Banana, that actually looks like, well, if you know the album cover and you've peeled it and seen, you know what I'm talking about. But it's not true, though he does connect to this story a little later. It was actually designed by a guy named John Pasch, who at the time was a graduating student of the Royal College of Art in London. So one of their reps calls him up and says, hey, design us a logo. We're not happy with what Decca Records is giving us. We need something new, something fresh. John Pasch designs something up, and it's immediately rejected. The Stones did not like it. So clearly it wasn't what we know now. So John thinks, well, botch that job, wait for the next one. But he gets called again, and they're like, oh, we'll give you another shot here. And he designs a logo based on the Concorde Turbojet 500. So the Rolling Stones logo was almost an airplane, with a little Rolling Stones on the top tail. Mick Jagger actually called him and said, nah, you can do better than this. I know you're good. One more try. In fact, come have a meeting with me, and we'll talk it over. And during that meeting, Mick Jagger was showing him a picture of the Hindu deity Kali. And in this painting, Kali had her tongue out. And he says, give me something like that. But also give me something that could easily be drawn on a notebook, on a program cover, press book. So Pasch goes home one more time, creates the mouth and lips with its big bold lines and bright red colors. Third time's a charm. It absolutely clicks. However, Mick and some friends of the band think, is this guy taking the piss a little bit with us? Because this looks like my lip. Because if anybody's seen a picture of Mick Jagger in the 60s and 70s, the dude had some big lips. Pasch even says, yeah, I was probably thinking about it slightly, subconsciously. But no hard feelings. Pasch ends up getting paid an extra £200 on top of the £50 he was already promised just to do the logo. The logo is the perfect anti-authority with sexual overtones logo that perfectly reflects the Stones and takes them into the next phase of their career. And after debuting on VIP press passes March 26, 1971, it's used as the insert logo in the Stones' latest album, Sticky Fingers, that same year. Oh, and by the way, Andy Warhol, that's where he ties back into the story. He took that picture of the dude's crotch that is that cover. That's a wild story too, involving some dude looking for an architect walking into his office and seeing him take pictures of dudes in their crotches. But that's probably a story for another time. John Pasch gets $250 for designing a logo that has resulted in billions of dollars worth of sales, but he doesn't have any hard feelings because that's just part of the job. But we can respect him now with an album and a band that wouldn't really be the same without his handiwork. From Sticky Fingers and the first album incarnation of the tongue and mouth logo, this is Wild Horses. Wow, we've hit the end of another liner note leftovers already? Crazy to think, considering all we covered. Aliens, communism, Van Hagar, the Hindu goddess Kali, and her impact on the Rolling Stones. Crazy, crazy times, but we just scratched the surface of rock and roll. If we talked about everything, we'd be here until the end of time. But don't worry, next week we'll have all new stories on another liner note leftovers. But in the meantime, I leave you with this parting advice as always. Grab life and your records by the edges. I'll see you next Friday.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to myloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.